If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. During the 17th and 18th centuries, the Jacobite movement made several attempts to restore the Stuart dynasty to the British throne. And on today's Everything You Wanted to Know episode, we're speaking to Murray Pittock, who's answering your questions on who the Jacobites were and what they wanted. Putting your questions to Murray was BBC History Revealed staff writer Emma Slattery-Williams.
We've had a lot of questions in about the Jacobites from our readers on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, and also some of the biggest Google searches. So I think the first question should be, who were the Jacobites and what does the name Jacobite mean?
So the name Jacobite simply means a follower or supporter of James, because it was James II of England and Ireland and 7th of Scotland, who was the last monarch in the direct Stuart line and was exiled in 1688, and his supporters became known as Jacobites. What did they want? Who were they? They were the supporters of James initially, but the reason the Jacobites are still popular and important today is because they represent a different version of the way in which Great Britain and Ireland could have developed. So whereas English Jacobites wanted the Stuarts back, they distrusted the city of London. They distrusted the new financial markets that came in the 1690s. They didn't much like foreigners being ruled by Dutch and Germans and so on. And they tended also to be partisans of a Church of England, which the king, as a high Anglican, or indeed even a Catholic, since they were supporting the Stuarts in exile, was a legitimate ruler. But the Scots and Irish tended to want the Stuarts back for different reasons. They wanted them back because they wanted a multi-kingdom monarchy such as had obtained in the British Isles before 1689, and particularly before 1707, which is the union between England and Scotland. So they wanted a different constitutional settlement and a different religious settlement, Catholicism back in Ireland, Episcopalianism back in Scotland. And English Jacobitism tended to be much more a series of kind of resentments about foreigners, resentments about London, resentments about traditional ways of life being under attack. So that's really very diverse things that Jacobitism represented to different people.
Could you briefly explain why James II had been removed from the throne in 1688 and why this group wanted him reinstated?
Well, James was removed because, first of all, he was a Catholic king. He was the first Catholic king, not the first Catholic ruler in England since the Reformation. And whereas it was widely expected that he would die without any legitimate children, illegitimate sons, I should say. His daughters were both Protestant, so that was all right. So the birth of his son, James, on the 10th of June, 1688, led a number of leading figures in the House of Lords and Commons in Westminster to ask James's son-in-law and nephew, William of Orange, the ruler of the Netherlands, to invade in order to secure a Protestant succession, or at least, this was very ambivalent, at least to confine the king's rights so that he couldn't run roughshod over parliamentary sovereignty. And the definition of parliamentary sovereignty, as we now understand it, was a really important part of the way the 1688-89 Parliament defined the conflict between themselves and the king.
Katie Pinner has asked on Twitter, how did the Jacobite movement start?
The Jacobite movement really started by the process of the king's exclusion. So when James II and VII was excluded, first of all, by the English Parliament in the end of 1688, and then by the Scottish Parliament in April 1689, in the first case leading to the Bill of Rights and the second to the Claim of Right, then the Jacobites who opposed this resisted in the case, in the military case. They resisted in Scotland under Viscount Dundee, who was James' supreme commander of the Scottish Armed Forces and remained loyal to the king in exile. And although Dundee won an initial victory, he was killed in the moment of victory. In England, there were widespread but rather limited complaints and protests rather than actually a military movement. England was a very demilitarized society. And in Ireland, where the Jacobites remained in control of the Irish Parliament till the end of 1691, there was full-scale war involving tens of thousands of troops. And James's Irish viceroy, the Duke of Tyrconnell, raised 30,000 men and required a large-scale Anglo-Dutch force and 2 years' war to finally defeat him and the Irish forces. And the Ireland we have today, the division between Northern Ireland and the Republic, the whole ethos of Ulster Unionism descends ultimately from the conflict of 1689-91, which defeated the Jacobites in Ireland. So it's a complicated picture. It's different in each of the three kingdoms. And the politics of Jacobitism differed in England, Scotland, and Ireland. That's one of the most important points about it. For those who primarily saw James as wanted James back because he was the legitimate king, one of the important things for listeners to know is that James, is that the House of Stuart was the senior heir. It was the heir to the throne. Okay, but he was also the senior heir of the House of Tudor through the marriage of Henry VII to James IV of Scotland to Margaret Tudor. He was also the senior heir of the House of Plantagenet through multiple marriages of the Scottish kings to the daughters of English ones. It was also the senior heir of the House of Wessex, the Anglo-Saxon house, through the marriage of Margaret of Scotland, the niece of Edward the Confessor, to Malcolm III of Scotland. So fundamentally, the Stuarts were the only legitimate heirs. They were overwhelmingly legitimate. And that led to people really feeling that the overthrowing them was too great a disjunction, too great a usurpation, too great a change. And there were all sorts of contemporary anxieties as well, like if you were overthrow the Stuarts, how can sons, as it was then, be secure in inheriting their father's estates? Because we've done away with the right of primogeniture, and we've not just done away with it slightly, we've done away with it enormously. Because when George I came to the throne in 1714, there were 57 people with a better claim than he had. All of them, however, were Catholics.
I think that leads quite nicely on to the next question of who actually was involved in the movement. I think we have an assumption that they were all Scottish, but I think you're saying that that wasn't necessarily the case. So who was actually involved? Was it ordinary people? Was it nobility?
There are many nobles who support the Jacobites. They do so for reasons varying from patriotism and nationalism to personal friendship and connection with the royal family. And sometimes, of course, they're the illegitimate children or related or married to the illegitimate children of members of the royal family. So there are a lot of reasons there. But there is a lot of popular Jacobite support. And Jacobite medals, Jacobite images were used as propaganda. For example, one Kentish fishing boat was apprehended in 1698 with 7,000 medals, which showed the pictures of James the a portrait of James II. So there was widespread popular Jacobitism, and that was true in England and in Scotland, and particularly in Ireland, and also, and again, particularly from Scotland and Ireland, a large number of soldiers, men volunteered to serve abroad in the service of France and Spain, and also to some extent of Russia and Austria, rather than serve in the British Army.
How big was the movement? How many people are we talking?
The estimates vary, but if we were to say, roughly speaking, that at 1714, the point when George I comes to the throne, a quarter of a century after James has been exiled, we'd be talking about 75% of the population of Ireland supporting the Jacobites. And that is about 1 to 1.5 million people. So the population of Ireland is very much closer to half to a third to a half England's. So very different from what the situation is now. And in England, very difficult to tell. Some probably about, this would be just a guess, 10 to 20% of the population supported the Jacobites, more in certain areas. And in Scotland, a clear majority supported the Jacobites. So we're talking there, over the terms of the population, probably around 600,000 people.
How many Jacobite risings were there? Could you briefly outline what these were?
So the first Jacobite rising or war occurred in Scotland in 1689 to 91. And in a sense, the Massacre of Glencoe came at the end of that. And there was also a war in Ireland at the same time, which ran all the way through. There was then an assassination plot in England in 1696, a rising or planned rising in Scotland, which petered out in 1708, a rising in Scotland in 1715, which was massive, a rising in Scotland in 1719, an assassination or coup d'etat plot in England in 1722 to 23, a rising in Scotland again in 1745, an attempt by the French crown in 1759, and I've just skipped over the Elibank plot, which was another English coup d'etat, but orchestrated by Scottish Jacobites to a significant extent in 1753. So quite a lot.
Yeah. So Jessica Roberts on Facebook asked, were the prospects of returning a Stuart to the throne ever a strong possibility? Were any of these uprisings close to being victorious?
The answer to that question is probably not. The one which stood the best chance of success was the rising of 1715 because of the strength of its support, but it was also the worst led. And the one that came closest to success was the rising of 1745, where the Charles Edward Stuart's commanders forced him to turn back from Derby when he wanted to go on to London. On that occasion, the military dispositions were such that the Jacobites would undoubtedly have entered London. And so we really don't know what would have happened after that, but probably there would have been enough anti-Catholicism and enough British troops and British allied troops in the field to defeat them. We don't know. But that was the closest they came, 1745. 1715 was the closest that they should have come, but didn't. One thing to notice about all those risings is there was a very large British Army garrison in Ireland throughout most of that period. And so Ireland isn't actually involved in any of the Jacobite risings directly to any extent after 1691 too.
So you just mentioned there Charles Edward Stuart, who was also known as Bonnie Prince Charlie. Who was he and what was his role in the Jacobite uprisings?
So Charles Edward Stuart, Bonnie Prince Charlie, was the elder son of James the 8th and 3rd, as he was known to his supporters, that son of James the 2nd and 7th, who was born on 10th June 1688. Charles was born right at the end, the last day of 1720. And he was brought up, basically, to lead another Jacobite rising. And he landed, he attempted to lead a rising in 1744. I missed that one out in the recent whistle-stop tour, which was actually stopped by bad weather, and then led the rising of 1745. So he did that as Prince Regent. That was his official title. But he was looking to restore his father.
Was he a good leader?
Charles Edward was an excellent strategic leader. He knew what had to be done. And one of his great frustrations was he wasn't a particularly good tactical leader. He would get a lot of things wrong in battlefield tactics. But he had got a lot of battlefield tacticians under him who didn't quite understand the strategic side. So first of all, a lot of his supporters wanted to just set up a kingdom in Scotland and not restore the Stuarts in London. And that was impractical because the financial and military power of Great Britain was just too great for that to work without huge amounts of consistent French support, which France wasn't going to give. So that they also took the view that they would get more English Jacobite support than they did. I'm not sure he was ever quite so confident as they were, because he knew that in 1651, Charles II, his great uncle, had come down to Worcester with a Scottish army and got virtually no English support then either. But what he principally knew was that Charles I, his great grandfather, Charles I, had not advanced on London during the war with Parliament in the 1640s, and that not advancing on London was his critical mistake. If he'd advanced on London after Edge Hill, he'd probably have won.
So can we just go back a moment? You mentioned Glencoe. Could you briefly explain what happened there?
As a result of the settlement of the Jacobite War in Scotland, the supporter in 1691, the supporters of King James in Scotland were given to a certain date to surrender to the government of King William and the Scottish Parliament. MacDonald of Glencoe was late surrendering, partly because he left it to the last minute, partly because of bad weather. And it was decided to make an example of him. And so what was horrific about it was the example was basically orchestrated by Scottish politicians with the support of King William, was that those soldiers who were to massacre the MacDonalds, and the idea was to massacre the man, woman, and child. It was not to make an example of MacDonald of Glencoe or some of his senior leaders, were first of all to be billeted on them, and they were to host the soldiers. So they hosted the soldiers, and then fortunately the alarm was raised and a lot of the MacDonalds got away, but a large number of them were killed. And what was horrific about it was murder under the guise of hospitality. There was an official crime in Scots law, which was a petty treason called murder under trust, which this was an example of. So it really offended, the way it was done really offended the Scottish legal tradition and offended cultural sensibilities as well. Because there certainly was a lot of brutality in the wars of those days, but not usually being asked to billet people in your houses who then decide to kill you after a couple of weeks.
Do we know how many people were killed?
Yes, it's a few dozen. In terms of global atrocities, it's not a huge number, but he was seen as symptomatic of an insensitive and brutal government action, which helped to foment exactly the kinds of feelings it was designed to suppress.
So we've had a few questions about this. How much support did the Jacobites have out of England, Scotland and Ireland? Presumably Catholic countries would have been on their side to wanting to restore Catholicism.
Well, the Stuarts didn't really offer, first of all, to restore Catholicism. What the Stuarts offered to do was to give greater rights to the Catholics in Ireland, to restore the Episcopalian Church, the equivalent of the Anglicans in Scotland, and in the Church of England, probably to try and lift the penal laws, in England to lift the penal laws against Catholics. So it wasn't anything like a counter-reformation. It was more, you know, fair deal for Catholics. Remember, at this stage, Catholics can't actually join the British Army at all, officially, legally. So they're excluded from all public office. They're excluded from the universities. So in that sense, the Stuarts were serving the Catholic interest, but they weren't going to restore the Catholic Church. They got support from a variety of sources. Their most consistent supporter was perhaps unsurprisingly France, because France and Great Britain were locked in a struggle to which would be the greatest empire in the world throughout most of the 18th century. The Stuarts got significant support at certain times from Spain, who sent around 400 soldiers and weapons and explosives to support the rising of 1719. They also got support from Russia because of the closeness of Orthodoxy and some of the Episcopalians. There were very close links there, and there were close links culturally between Scotland and Russia too. They also at times got support or close to support from Prussia and Sweden. So no, it didn't have to be a Catholic power. They appealed to quite a lot of non-Catholic powers, because one of the issues after 1714, and we really write this out of British history completely, was that the accession of George I to the thrones of England, Scotland, and Ireland led also to Hanover being incorporated into the possessions of Great Britain. And he was the king of Hanover. And only with Queen Victoria did that stop, because Hanover wouldn't allow a woman to come to the throne. But Hanover was a small Central European state. And basically, a lot of the support and the political language about support the Jacobites had came from the fact that other European states didn't like the fact that this small state, Hanover, effectively now had the backing of this very large offshore island with a colonial empire behind it. And of course, in England, people didn't much like the fact that British money and troops were sent to support Hanover. So it was a two-way street. But we kind of write Hanover out of British history, but it was actually, you know, not quite just as much a part of Britain as Wiltshire in 1750, but it was a lot closer than you might think.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
There might have been no French Revolution, which would also have meant no Napoleon. So although these could to some extent get fanciful the further you go down that route, there's no doubt that the Jacobites, defeat of the Jacobites, changed the future of the world.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So in 1707, the Act of Union came in, which united the kingdoms of England and Scotland. What effect did this have on the Jacobites?
The Union had very little effect on Irish or English Jacobitism, but it massively increased support for Scottish Jacobitism. So Scottish Jacobitism, which was perhaps not supported by a majority of the political nation prior to 1707, was very definitely supported by a majority of the political nation after 1707, because it was the primary means of being able to rescind the union.
So Adam Hillhouse has asked on Facebook, did most clan chiefs declare for or against the Stuarts for religious, ideological, or pragmatic political reasons?
I think the best way to answer that question is yes, in the sense that all of these things were important. But one thing to notice about the 1715 rising, where the Jacobites got more support than they got in any other rising from Scotland, is that the commander of that rising, even though at the time he'd been supporter of the Union himself, the Earl of Mar, he changed his mind and had the zeal of a convert about it, actually put the political settlement above the restoration of the dynasty in his public statements and what he released. So I think we could say the union is the key driver of popular, to some extent, of elite Jacobitism, followed by pragmatic, dynastic, and simply considerations of personal bankruptcy, adventurism, or opportunism. So all those elements, but in Scotland, the union is the major element after 1707.
So we had this question on Instagram. What did women do within the Jacobite movement?
One of the interesting things about women in the Jacobite movement is just how central they were to it. They were frequently utilised because they were mostly there was a disinclination to prosecute women for printing seditious materials, for raising men even. Which they certainly did. Of course, Anne McIntosh, who was by marriage a McIntosh, by birth of Farquharson, the daughter of Farquharson of Invercall, she raised a regiment around about 300 or 400 men and became its notional commander, though its day-to-day commander was a man called Alexander McGilvery. So women played a significant role. They were also very widely used in Jacobite espionage. They also were used in Jacobite art networks. And indeed, Andrew Lumsden, who was the secretary to the Jacobite court in Rome, frequently patronized female art in the sense of was their patron rather than patron of being patronizing female artists, and ensured that they were developed by some of the contemporary painters, male painters in the Papal States. So women played a very central role in the Jacobite cause, it would be fair to say, partly because the Jacobites had a different view of women's place in society. I mean, not a radically different view, but not one which was quite so constrained as what became the norms of polite British society in the late 18th, early 19th century. And also because they were very useful, frankly, because they were very unlikely to be prosecuted. And this was noticed by the authorities. So the female rebels and the unnatural rebels were all parts of government propaganda after 1745. The fact that Jacobites were detaching women from their true role in society was a small but definitely present part of anti-Jacobite propaganda.
So Peter John Mills asked on Facebook, how serious was the Jacobite threat to the Hanoverians?
Ultimately, the Jacobites were extremely irritating, but to the Hanoverian dynasty, but they only came even remotely close to a chance of toppling them in 1745. However, they were a perpetual anxiety. They were even within England, they were kind of like a minority that won't go away. And in Scotland, they helped to render the country almost ungovernable without military intervention. In Ireland, large numbers of troops had to be deployed to ensure that it remained governable. So they were a real irritant.
So the final stand for the Jacobites was the Battle of Culloden. Could you just briefly explain what that battle was, what happened during the battle?
The Jacobite army was in retreat throughout most of late 1745, the end of 1745 and early 1746. There were some small reversals in the retreats, but basically they were retreating. The Duke of Cumberland, as commander of the British forces in Scotland, was advancing on them. Inverness was the last borough of any size, the last town of any size that the Jacobites held. And so it was the last store for their food, for their ammunition, for their supplies, because they relied on being not a guerrilla army, but a fast-moving army. And basically, they didn't have the horses and they didn't have the capacity to drag their supplies around with them endlessly. So Culloden was fought to contest the road into Inverness. The issue about the battle is that it was not fought on the site that had originally been chosen by the Quartermaster General, Colonel John Sullivan, because there was an attempt to carry out a night attack, which launched late, partly because the Royal Navy were on the Moray Firth, and it's quite light in Scotland by mid-April, so they could be seen if they'd set off too early, but partly because of the disorganisation and difficulty of carrying out a night attack over several miles of open country. So the night attack failed and they came back and fought the battle on a site they never intended to fight it on, and were ultimately defeated, not, as a popular story has it, by the victory of muskets over swords, but because the British army had significantly greater numbers of cavalry, and the cavalry carried out a successful enveloping, successful or almost successful movement of envelopment over the Jacobite army. And also because the Jacobites, because they didn't fight on any ground that they'd really chosen, were faced with bad ground over part of the area over which they would normally have charged. And also the left and right wings couldn't see each other because of the contours of the ground at the point where the army lined up. So there were a lot of contributory factors, but basically the strength of the British cavalry and dragoon, that's mounted infantry, so effectively cavalry arm, was absolutely critical to winning the battle.
Do we know how many people were involved in the battle?
We do. So there probably just under 5,000 Jacobites and round about 8,000 British regulars.
So how did the battle change Scotland and its relationship with England?
Well, in a sense, Culloden's quite a small battle. And in a sense, if the Jacobites had won Culloden, it wouldn't have made a huge amount of difference. They would have lost in the end. It changed a great deal, nonetheless. First of all, because the British government had become very frightened indeed by the 45. It had come very close from their point of view. And Cumberland in particular was determined that nothing like this would ever happen again. And he authorised immense and immediate brutalisation of large areas of Scotland, but he also authorised a long-standing occupation, which lasted really until the late 1750s, early 1760s. And probably at that point, for example, things like cricket were introduced into Scotland. So it wasn't all brutality. Quite often there were long-stay garrisons in the boroughs and towns. It's very interesting they got on with, you know, people locally, or they didn't, but, you know, it was a fact of life. That was the immediate aftermath in Scotland. But the trouble was that they couldn't... Cumberland initially thought that troops would only be needed for 6 weeks, but they needed for an awful lot longer. And it was only when Scottish troops became incorporated into the British Army at large scale in the 1750s that the situation was fundamentally resolved and disquiet and difficulty in controlling Scotland died away. So the impact of Scottish troops at scale on the Seven Years' War, the War of 1756-63 with France, was absolutely critical. And to take one example, one of the reasons that General Wolfe, in fact, probably the key reason General Wolfe's troops were able to get onto the Plains of Abraham and to defeat Montcalm and the French in 1759 was that one of their officers was a former, a man called MacDonald, was a former Scottish officer in the French service and spoke perfect French, and so was able to get past the French sentries. It changed an enormous amount in terms of the British Empire. The deportations carried out against French citizens in Canada by the British Army and authorities in the late 1750s were modelled on what Cumberland would have liked to do, and to some extent, but only to a small extent, did manage to do in the Scottish Highlands. But ultimately, the defeat of the Jacobites is a critical moment in world history because, first of all, it's unlikely that the Seven Years' War, which was the ultimate contest for the success of the British Empire, would ever have been fought if the Stuarts had been restored. If it hadn't been fought, there are all sorts of reasons, with a big French military presence, why the American colonies would not have been able to revolt. And also the enormous expenditure that France went to contest with the Hanoverians, the top empire role, would not have taken place. There would have been a better relationship with the Stuart monarchy. And so the French would not have got so far into debt that they couldn't deal with the agricultural crisis in the 1780s. And there might have been no French Revolution, which would also have meant no Napoleon. So although these could to some extent get fanciful the further you go down that route, there's no doubt that the Jacobites, defeat of the Jacobites, changed the future of the world.
What effect did it have on the traditional clan system in Scotland?
It would be proper to think really of Scotland as having a feudal system, which had slightly different ways of expressing itself depending where you were in the country. So it was a feudal. Sometimes rental was paid largely in kind, which could include military service. Sometimes it was paid largely in cash. But even people who paid cash rents often offered military service too. So the government legislation sought to completely undermine the control Scottish landlords have over their tenants, particularly the control to judge them in boroughs of regality, to be able to inflict the death penalty on tenants who've been found guilty of capital crimes. So basically the control of the Scottish nobility over their tenantry was much reduced by the legislation after 1745. And that began to change the relationship forever, though it took a very long time to actually finally change it, because there were very strongly culturally embedded reasons why it still commanded the allegiance of a lot of people.
So after Culloden, what happened to the Jacobites? Were there any further attempts after 1745?
there was only one real further attempt, which is the French attempt in 1759, which was defeated by Admiral Hawke at the Battle of Quiberon Bay, which would have entailed the restoration of the Stuarts. There would have been further attempts, but Charles Edward, of course, there was also a plot in London in 1753. Charles Edward didn't want any further attempt that only focused on Scotland. He was concerned and remained rather sentimentally sorry for the end of his life, to the end of his life, for the enormous loss of life and what he regards as the inadequate French support that had sustained the rising. So he wasn't prepared to do that again. But so there were those two in the 53 plot and 59. But funnily enough, as late as 1795, after the French Revolution, the French government, the Directory, contacted the United Irishmen in Ireland, who were at that time preparing for what became the Irish Rising in 1798, and asked if they would like Charles's brother Henry to lead them, who was still alive at this time. And they said, no, things have moved on.
So what happened to Charles Edward Stuart?
He died with alcoholism, certainly a contributory factor, though he lived to a reasonable age for the 18th century in early 1788 at the age of 67.
Are there any descendants of James II still claiming the right to be monarch today? Quite a few people ask this question.
They don't claim the right to be monarch, but there are quite a few descendants of James VII and II on the go, as it were. So the main line is the Grand Dukes of Bavaria. That is now the main line of the Stuarts. They're very well aware that they are the claimants, but they've absolutely no interest in it. There are also descendants of James's illegitimate son, the Duke of Berwick, in the Dukes, James Stuart y Folco, I think it's the Dukes of Berwick and Lyria, who are grandees of Spain, are direct descendants of James.
So someone asked on Instagram, how much of our understanding of the Jacobite cause has been shaped by the work of Sir Walter Scott?
Scott really took his models from 18th century Scottish Enlightenment historiography, the practice of history. So as part of what we might call a discourse of reconciliation in the late 18th century, Scottish history started to present the Stuarts as utterly mistaken, an unfortunate accident, but nonetheless sentimentally attractive. You know, they have an appeal and it's understandable. People supported them, but, you know, it was ultimately a mistake. Times have moved on, that kind of thing. So not condemning them, but allowing the emotions surrounding them to be primarily ones of nostalgia, but nostalgia which is safely distanced by sentiment from being anything meaningful. In other words, depoliticizing them. So Walter Scott, that interpretation lies behind a good deal of what Walter Scott wrote, though he actually does offer some very interesting countervailing suggestions. For example, in Rob Roy, Diana Vernon, who's his incomparably in some ways his best heroine, presents the positive attitude of Jacobite womanhood and challenges some of the notions of civility in the new rising generation. So he was influential, but a lot of that was because he made a really good story out of a point of view and approach towards the Jacobite cause, which had already been developed in the history of William Robertson and others.
A lot of people have asked about how realistic the portrayal of the Jacobite cause is in the TV series Outlander.
The answer is really that Outlander isn't particularly realistic in respect to the Jacobite cause. It tends to the view of Jacobites as victims of elites, and which is characteristic of Peter Watkins' film Culloden, made in 1964, which itself was very strongly related to John Preble's argument in Culloden. And it comes from a fundamentally Marxist reading of the Jacobite cause, which is historically, I mean, I'm not suggesting that the Outlanders are Marxist books, not at all. But the idea is that that people would never have done this if they hadn't been tricked or deceived or into doing it. And that isn't really the way Jacobitism functioned at all. People were passionate about it. And the fact Interestingly, that the books have sold, whatever is it, over 30 million copies, people remain so very interested in Jacobitism, is actually testament to the fact that it was hardly an elite trick paid on ordinary people at all. It was a very widespread and important political movement. Some of the questions it asked have not been appropriately resolved to today, and it represents a fault line in the way in which British society and politics developed, which is still visible. It's still visible in Northern Ireland. It's still, I have to say, visible in the Brexit process and the predominantly European alignments of Jacobites and Jacobite supporters. And it's visible in other. It's also visible in the distrust of London and London financial markets. All of those things date right back to the Jacobite era and were core motivations for Jacobite action. So the popularity of Jacobitism really works against the idea that it was a bit of elite trickery. And frankly, in other words, the popularity of Outlander demonstrates that the history of Outlander isn't altogether correct.
So I think we often have this idea of Bonnie Prince Charlie as a romantic hero. As you said, the works of Walter Scott, and I believe Queen Victoria was quite a fan of Walter Scott, and she even admired Bonnie Prince Charlie. Do you think that's right to see him as this kind of romantic hero that just didn't succeed?
Well, I think the romantic hero is what the late 18th century and Walter Scott and his successors made of him. So he's not a romantic hero in that he's an 18th century politician. He represents a diverse and very difficult to manage, because they've got contradictory goals, political movement, and he's got certain virtues and certain vices, like most, indeed all of us, and particularly of politicians and leaders, where these things are magnified by the scale of the decisions they're taking. So it's much better to view him as normal and take it from there, because one of the reasons we don't understand the Jacobites particularly well is because they're covered in this romantic mythology, which has been sustained interest in them for such a long time, but at the same time prevents us saying, how do they fit into 18th century politics? How do they fit into international politics? What is the global significance of Jacobitism? It's not about the Highlands. It's not about Gaelic. It's not about the aristocracy. It's not about an old-fashioned culture. It's about an alternative political vision. And that alternative political vision reflects divisions in society which have echoes today.
Were there any sympathies within British government for the Jacobite cause at the time?
This depends on which time. So there were quite a lot of members of Parliament who were sympathetic to the Jacobites in the 1690s and up to 1714. One of the reasons that George I excluded the Tories, as they not exactly the modern Conservative Party, but they were called the Tories, from office between 1714, and indeed his son did too, so right all the way to 1760, was because they were suspected of being Jacobites. So they were actually excluded formally from office after 1714. They probably weren't all Jacobites. In fact, they certainly weren't all Jacobites. There were a lot of Jacobites among them. But of course, actually excluding them from office didn't help them to stop being Jacobites, because that meant the only route for many Tories back to office would be a Jacobite restoration.
And I think this will be my last question for you. What do you think are the biggest misconceptions we have about the Jacobites and their uprisings?
The biggest misconceptions are, first, that they were romantic, tribal, outside the normal run of 18th century politics. They were a critical part of 18th century politics. That's one of the key misconceptions, perhaps the key misconception we have. The second is that they were doomed to defeat. People don't take these actions if they think they're doomed to defeat and risk their lives. They didn't think they were doomed to defeat, and they weren't necessarily doomed to defeat. If the cards had fallen well, the odds could have gone in their favor, but they were always more likely to lose than to win. That, however, is a very different question, and with the benefit of, as the Prime Minister would say, Captain Hindsight, at the time, people were very worried about the Jacobites indeed, because they didn't think they were bound to lose. And we'll understand 18th century Britain better if we understand that.
That was Murray Pittock, Professor of Literature at the University of Glasgow and Honorary Scottish History Advisor to the National Trust for Scotland. He's written several books on Scottish history, including Culloden and The Myth of the Jacobite Clans, the Jacobite Army in 1745. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.